on a Sunday morning in January, under the chilly shadow of the Pulaski Skyway. The house of beauty is burning. Who lobbed the fire bottle through the glass, in among the creams and thrones, the helmets and clippers and combs? Who set the house of beauty burning?
Welcome to Book Tour. I am Netta Ulibi. This week, a roundup of readings from this year's National Book Awards. We'll start with fiction reader Peter Matheson, who's written about a real-life historical figure named E.J. Watson for decades. Watson was not a pleasant man. He was a turn-of-the-century cane farmer in Florida and ran a plantation upon which folks had a habit of turning up dead. This is the fourth of three novels Matheson has published about Watson. It's called Shadow Country.
Please forgive me for my peculiar voice. I was flying at about 30,000 feet last week, and I was struck deaf and dumb by some mysterious circumstance, and they have not recovered yet. And so perhaps I'd better stop talking here and read before my eyes conk out as well. This is a short chapter in the life of my protagonist, Mr. Watson, who is an eligible bachelor at this stage, as he's been a few times before. He is, however, operating under a cloud, being a suspected killer. But he's nonetheless still in the game. Mr. Watson, if nothing else, is full of life. William Parker Bethay, a Baptist minister, sharecropped a piece of the plantation across the Fort White Road. His widowed daughter from his first marriage came to visit, and somebody suggested to both parties that Mrs. Lola McNair and Mr. E.J. Watson might take kindly to each other. Having nothing in the world against sweet widows, I fluffed up my whiskers, borrowed red trap with bright gold spokes, and sparkled over there of a nice Sunday to pay my respects. The Reverend, in black preaching coat, white socks, and high black shoes, was sitting in a rocker on his front porch. "Good day, sir," said I. "E.J. Watson is my name. I've come a-calling." When I lifted my hat and introduced myself, he rose from his chair as if prepared to defend his hearth and home. But like so many in the preaching line, he looked like a more steadfast man than he turned out to be. "Yes, sir," he said in a stiff voice. "We know who you are." Hearing those cold words, I almost left without hesitation. But even as he spoke, Preacher Bethay was hastening out into the sunlight for a better look at my red trap with its bright gold spokes, after which he waved me up onto the porch, saying, "Make yourself to home here, Mr. Watson." Watching me was a young girl in a white frock who stood behind his rocker like a servant. She had wide brown eyes and a calm and kindly face and long, soft, taffy-colored hair down past her shoulders. This was not the widow, but her younger sister, Catherine Edna, handsome and pretty both. Showing nice manners for this part of the country, she curtsied to her father's guest and ever so winsome skipped away to fetch her sister. What Preacher Bethay was up to in that moment, only his Lord knew. My guess was he was tussling with the devil. But even before I flapped my coattails up and sat my arse down in his rocker, I knew this man would never give me trouble. As farmer and preacher, he was well acquainted with my neighbors, and surely he'd heard rumors about E.J. Watson. Yet never once on this day or later did this man seek to assure himself that this stranger of dark repute would not sully his daughter. He had two new kids and a third one in the oven, and no doubt dreaded the burden of the widow and her children somewhat more than permitting her younger sister to fall into the grasp of a known criminal. By now, Catherine Edna had returned, busting out onto the porch all in a flurry. When she smoothed her skirt and bowed forward a little to sit down on the steps, I could not help but note the apple bosom swelling in her frock. However, that was my own need. There was no guile in her. As she noticed all my noticing, she gave no sign, just beamed in my face like a fresh fruit pie. By the time Miss Lola had joined us on the porch, it was already too late. I had my wicked sights set on her sister. All in a moment, Catherine Edna, whom I would call Kate, had twisted my loins hard. "Expected you Saturday," the preacher said, a little sour. "Lola's just fixing to leave." The widow Lola had the same calm, kindly manner as her sister, but also the sad quiet in her face of a young woman suddenly condemned to live mostly in the past, who expects little or nothing from the future. Her hair was up in a big roll on her head, the way all married women wore it, and childbearing had thickened her a little through the midriff. Lola McNair did not stay long. She was taking the afternoon train. The Reverend went off to hitch up his buggy to drive her and her children to the junction. When she rose to go, she took my hand, smiling a little, having sensed what was already taking place. "So," she drawled that small word slowly, "Mr. Watson." I bowed. We exchanged a smile. Releasing my hand, she said how much she'd enjoyed meeting me, adding, "Next time, you all come calling just a little sooner." Miss Lola was not flirtatious, and she was not teasing me, only herself, having lost a suitor before she had even laid eyes on him, even before she knew whether she might want him. And she did not mind that I had seen her bittersweet glimmer of regret. All of that went back and forth between us with not one word spoken. That woman and I were friends from the first moment, as if we had been lovers in some other life. I loved her sister, but I loved her too, being full to overflowing with a grand, bold feeling. And yet she was protective of young Kate, and her eyes were troubled. Unlike her father, she did not pretend she had not heard the rumors. That shadow went back and forth between us two. Thank you.
Our next reader won in the category of nonfiction. Annette Gordon-Reed received massive critical praise for her book, The Hemingses of Monticello, An American Family. Gordon-Reed is a law professor who used Sally Hemings as her starting point. She moved forward and backwards in time and challenged historical orthodoxy about Thomas Jefferson's mistress and unearthed the story about another family at Jefferson's mountaintop plantation, Monticello.
I'm going to read a section from near the end of the book. The Hemingses have been at Monticello for almost 50 years, and the final catastrophe is upon them as Jefferson dies $107,000 in debt in 1826. That's a lot of money. The beginning of Jefferson Den started in June of 1826. The story of his final days was presented in the recollections of his white grandchildren, and their reflections illustrate the difference between the slave society that their mother and grandfather had been born into and the one that the younger Randolphs knew. While the Jefferson family memories of Martha Jefferson's death in 1782 make no mention of the enslaved women who surely helped care for the dying woman, enslaved people played prominent roles in Jefferson's grandchildren's recorded memories of his death. As Jefferson faded, his grandson, Jeff Randolph, and the others remembered that he would only have his servants sleeping near him. Randolph makes clear that more than one enslaved person was deeply involved with Jefferson's care in his final days. That is not surprising. There were more than enough Hemingses to stand watch, and in those intense moments, the attention of the entire place was riveted on the man who for over five decades had dominated the lives and imaginations of all the people who lived on the mountain. Randolph did not name all the servants who attended Jefferson, but it is almost certain that they included, at the very least, Burl Colbert and Sally Hemings, the only two people said to have taken care of his rooms and of him. As is often the case with those on their deathbeds, Jefferson had trouble sleeping, and people took turns sitting up with him during the day and at night. He did not want to be alone and insisted that his enslaved caregivers make pallets so that they could sleep in the room with him overnight. Only they were allowed in his bedroom after dark, and anxious members of the Randolph family took to making secret forays into his bedchamber to check on their own loved one. This is what it had come to. The people who had nursed him from the beginning of his life, whose energies he had harnessed for his own use up until this moment, were now called upon to care for him as he faced his last days on earth, sitting up with him at night, sleeping around his bed, to be ready to hear when he called out in need, in fear, or out of simple loneliness. These African Americans, whom he had sentimentalized as having the best hearts of any people in the world, had given their lives to him, followed him about, cleaned up after him, no doubt worried about him for his sake and their own, slept with him and borne him children, and he had held them as chattel, trying in the case of the Hemingses to soften a reality that could never be made soft. While he claimed to know and respect the quality of their hearts, he could never truly see them as human beings separate from him and his own needs, desires, and fears. In the end, all he really knew of their hearts was what they were willing to show him. And they carried enough knowledge in their heads to know his limitations and the perils of giving too much of themselves in the context of their society. The world they shared twisted and perverted practically everything it touched, made entirely human feelings and connections difficult, suspect, and compromised. What could have been in the hearts of any human beings living under the power of that system was inevitably complicated, inevitably tragic. It is often said that Americans lack a sense both of tragedy and of irony. Fawn Brody very rightly called what happened on the mountain in 1826 and its immediate aftermath the Monticello tragedy. It was certainly that, but obviously much more. It was a national tragedy, the natural result of America's engagement with the institution of slavery, the doctrine of white supremacy, and the nature of human frailty. The relationship of the Hemingses to the tragedy of slavery was unique only because they happened to be owned by one who made himself a public man, but wanted to keep private the world he really lived in with this particular African-American enslaved family. There's deep irony in this, too. What Jefferson accomplished for his children and some of their relatives was just what he said could not be accomplished in the nation as a whole. When freeing Burl Colbert, Joseph Fawcett, John Hemings, and Madison and Esten Hemings, the man who said he believed it impossible for blacks and whites to live together in the United States, and that people of African origin should be repatriated to another country, asked the legislature to allow these men to remain not just in America, but in Virginia. By the time Jefferson died, the American Colonization Society was up and running, and a few slave owners were freeing their slaves and making provision for their transportation to Liberia. They were acting on their deeply felt beliefs. What were Jefferson's likely true beliefs? The answer depends upon whether one chooses to pay more attention to what people say than what they actually do. Why not send the men he freed to Liberia? Jefferson gave the right answer to the question that likely never crossed his mind. The Hemingses should be allowed to remain in Virginia, he said, because that is where their families and connections were. That, of course, was the answer to the question why all other African Americans, most of whose ancestors who had come to America before, around the time as the African woman who had born Elizabeth Hemings, should be allowed to remain in the United States. Many of these people were the children, grandchildren, or great-grandchildren of white men, just like the men he freed. Their families and connections were in America, too. In truth, Jefferson did not mention race as the basis for the right to a home in America at all. Long-standing family ties and memories created the right. As was often the case, the public rhetorical Jefferson was very different from the down-to-personal business Jefferson, the one he seldom wanted anyone to see. The personal Jefferson had dominated the lives of the Hemingses. Their family connections to him, first through his wife and John Wales, and then the connections he created on his own with Sally Hemings, shaped the course of the family's existence. They also ensured that the world the Hemingses lived in with Jefferson would not be forgotten by their descendants and would remain a subject of fascination to the outside world. That is certainly not what Jefferson and what his white family wanted. But thankfully, they were not masters and mistresses across all space and time, and there is more to the world than law. The power of memory, love, and the strength of family kept alive the Hemingses' story. That we remember them today is the best and most fitting tribute to the no doubt terrified and unknown African who arrived on the shores of Virginia so many years ago to begin this family saga.
Next, we have poet Mark Doty, known for his playful formalism. He won for his collection of poems called Fire to Fire. The National Book Foundation described them as elegant, plain-spoken, and unflinching.
I am so pleased to be part of this company. I'm going to read just one poem. It borrows its form from the nursery rhyme, The House That Jack Built, or from Elizabeth Bishop's A Visit to Bedlam. Each stanza is one line longer than the one before, and each stanza ends with a version of the same line. It's called House of Beauty. In Jersey City, on Tonelli Avenue, the House of Beauty is burning. On a Sunday morning in January, under the chilly shadow of the Pulaski Skyway, the House of Beauty is burning. Who lobbed the fire bottle through the glass, in among the creams and thrones, the helmets and clippers and combs? Who set the House of Beauty burning? In the dark recess beside the sink, where heads lay back to be laved under the perfected heads rode along the walls, the hopeful photographs of possibility darken now that the House of Beauty is burning. The skyway beetles in the ringing cold, trestle arcing the steel river and warehouses, truck lots and Indian groceries, a new plume of smoke joining the others, billow of dark thought rising from the broken forehead of the House of Beauty. An emission almost too small to notice just now, alarm still ringing, the flames new launched on their project of ruining an effort at pleasure, glass jutting like cracked ice in the window frame. No one inside, the fire department on the way. All things by nature, wrote Virgil, are ready to get worse. No surprise, then, that the House of Beauty is burning. Though whatever happens, however far these fires proceed, reducing history to powder, whatever the House of Beauty made is untouchable now. Nothing can undo so many heads made lovely, or at least acceptable, so much shapelessness given what are called permanence, though nothing holds a fixed form. Bring on the flames. What does it matter if the house is burning? Propose a new beauty, perennially unhoused. Neither the lost things nor the fire itself, but the objects in their dresses of disaster. Anything clothed in its own passage. Padded vinyl chair burst into smoky tongues. Lucite helmet sagged to a new version of its dome. Our black bridge, a charred rainbow on iron legs, two ruby eyes glowering from its crown. If beauty is burning, what could you save? The House of Beauty is a house of flames.
We have one more reading. Judy Blundell has, under pseudonyms, cranked out over 100 novels written for the mass markets. Her latest came from her heart. It's a young adult novel called What I Saw and How I Lied. It's about a teenaged girl in a steamy Florida city right after World War II.
This book is set in 1947. Chapter 1. The match snapped, then sizzled, and I woke up fast. I heard my mother inhale as she took a long pull on a cigarette. Her lips stuck on the filter, so I knew she was still wearing lipstick. She'd been up all night. She lay on the bed next to me. I felt her fingers on my hair, and I kept sleep breathing. I risked a look under my eyelashes. She was in her pink nightgown, ankles crossed, head flung back against the pillows, arm in the air, elbow bent, cigarette glowing in her fingers, tanned legs glistening in the darkness, blonde hair tumbling past her shoulders. I breathed in smoke and mycin perfume. It was her smell. It filled the air. I didn't move, but I could tell she knew I was awake. I kept on pretending to be asleep. She pretended not to know. I breathed in and out, perfume and smoke, perfume and smoke, and we lay like that for a long time, until I heard the seagulls crying, and I knew it was almost morning. We never went to the hotel dining room now. They knew who we were. They'd seen our pictures in the paper. We knew they'd be saying, "Look at them eating toast. How can they be so heartless?" I rode a bike down to the beach instead. In the basket, I had a bottle of cream soda and two Baby Ruths, breakfast. The sky was full of stacked gray clouds, and the air tasted like a nickel. The sun hadn't had time to bake the wetness from the sand. I had the place to myself. When Alice fell down the rabbit hole, she fell slow. She had time to notice things on her way down. Oh, there's a teacup. There's a table. So things seemed almost normal to her while she was falling. Then she bumped down and rolled into Wonderland, and all hell broke loose. I'd noticed things on the way down, too. The way she walked away, her scarf trailing in her hand, flower petals, and a pineapple vase. So I've got to start from the very beginning, the day before we left for Florida. Just an ordinary day. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us on this special edition of Book Tour. For more readings and discussions like this one, visit npr.org/booktour.